Hello and welcome to another edition of Kaleidoscope. This is Magda Zenon recording from downtown Nicosia, and with me all the way from Gauteng, South Africa, I have Irene Stefano. Welcome, Irene.
Thank you so much, Magda Mo. Yeah. Prepping up is Gauteng.
Gauteng. It's Gauteng. I've been away, for those that don't know me, I'm South African born, but I've been away for too long, so I have lost the expression. So, Gauteng.
Yeah.
But to introduce you to Irene, first and foremost, she's an old family friend. Huh. Our fathers grew up in Strovolos together and emigrated to South Africa together. So as children, we spent a lot of time together as on Sundays. Sunday was the day for family to go. But in addition to being a cherished old friend, Irene is a performer. She's a playwright. She's an editor. She teaches drama. And she's all in all an awesome human being because she has had a successful one-woman career while being while having multiple sclerosis since a very young age. So to me, you're an absolute goddess, Irene. More welcome, a double welcome. But let's start at the beginning. Drama. How did drama come into your life? Because you studied drama at my old alma mater at Wits.
Yes, at Wits University. Well, it was never particularly intended, but when I was at school, I had these habits of being able to imitate teachers for all the other pupils around me and make them laugh. So I discovered that part of my performance life that was alive, and I could imitate the most horrible teachers only, not the nice ones. They were too nice. Yeah, but the horrible ones were good to imitate.
And being a good Greek Cypriot young woman, how did your family take you studying drama? Because drama was not considered to be a profession.
No, it was not. So, ironically, my mother sort of liked it because I think she thought it would make me more of a lady. Like, ser opos na milau kalake, na ime feminine. So I think she didn't mind, but I twisted their arm. So, yeah, I said I could teach drama. So that sort of seemed to calm everything down.
Okay, so you would be a teacher, which is more conventional.
Definitely, and acceptable,
Okay, and you worked a lot. A very big part of your career was at the Market Theatre in Johannesburg then, which was very innovative in its time because it was a multiracial theatre in the apartheid years of South Africa.
Yes, where mixed races were not allowed and no mixed castes. Actors on the stage. And in fact, in the olden days, it was terrible because some actors would black up. They'd put black makeup on their faces to play a black person because a real black person wasn't allowed on the stage. So it was pretty.
I mean, to put everyone to the context here, that's opened in 76, which was at the height of the apartheid regime. It was following the Soweto riots that caused chaos in our lives.
Yes.
And even us as young people, I mean, I remember being horrified of the domestic helper in the house. We would treat her like we treated every other human being. But the minute we stepped out of the house, if we were going to the supermarket or somewhere else, she needed to sit at the back seat. She couldn't sit next to me. She couldn't drink a cup of coffee with me.
No.
I think when I think of it, Irene, I think, how did we live through it?
Exactly. How did we? Well, you know, I do remember Magda as well, working in my father's shop. And there was a very drunk old black man, a customer, who came in the shop. And do you remember those days we had half white and half brown bread?
Black.
So, So this guy put the two half loaves on the counter. He said, I want one half white, one half brown. He said, Ian Bass and Ian K, that terrible word that we're not allowed to say, which is like the South African version of nigger, which we the N-word. Yeah, the N-word, which we're not allowed to say. So, right.
Tell me, how did you start collaborating at the Market Theatre? Did you know the people that owned it, Barney Simon?
I didn't know him then, but when I went to Wits, there were some people that were spreading a word of, you know, creating South African theatre, as in stories that were local, you know, not having to import plays from the first world that, you know, were undoubtedly better and superior, but actually making work about life in South Africa.
Okay. So you were able to, it was a place where you felt you could combine your talent or your tool of acting with your activism.
That's right. That's right. And in fact, for the last year of drama school, it was a big deal to get a monologue to perform. A monologue, you know, so people were looking at Shakespeare or Chekhov or some kind of European kind of writing. And I didn't have the energy to look. And I suddenly got this idea. And I thought, you know, I'm not going to find a monologue. I'm going to write my own monologue. And I did. And it was based on my mother.
Your mother, who I will always remember, what a beautiful woman she was. And what was it based on, the way she treated you as a young woman?
As girls, my sister and I, growing up to be girls, and what is a girl, and what do girls do and don't do, and of course, nase kaliko bela, a good girl, to find a kalopedi, you know.
A good boy, and preferably a Greek Cypriot one.
Of course, of course, yeah.
I remember those days.
You do. Did you marry a good Cypriot?
No, I married a good Greek and then I divorced him. But I have to say, Irini, I had quite broad-minded parents because my ex-husband courted me from abroad. He came to visit and whatever. And local people told my mother about what a good guy he was. And my mother said to them, you know what? My daughter doesn't need to get married. If you think he's such a good guy, give your daughter. My daughter's going to make the decision on her own. She doesn't need to get married. So I have to say,
how amazing of them. Mm. How amazing.
So I have to say I was blessed with having more open-minded parents.
Yes. Yes. Liberal-minded.
Yeah. Yes. Tell me, growing up, what was MS? How did MS influence your life and your life decisions?
Well, it was, it happened very mysteriously because when I was 16, I was just an ordinary girl at school, you know, everything was normal. And one day at break time, I noticed something funny with my eyes and I didn't realize what it was. And then I realized I was blind in one eye, in my left eye. So there was no explanation, no understanding. So they rushed me off to the doctor. He rushed me off to a specialist. And the specialist injected cortisone into my eyelid. And which was another thing, you know, Magda, I think you'll understand this also from a feminist perspective, because I was lying there and this doctor came with this huge injection and he was going to inject my eye. So I was terrified. So he said, just lie still. So of course I tried to lie still, but I couldn't. You know, my eyes were blinking all the time. And he said to me, "Don't be silly, you stupid girl."
Oh,
you know, I could find him to this day, I would tell him what for. You know, I was a 16-year-old child. I was terrified.
Terrified.
There was this huge injection coming to my eye, you know. So you don't treat people like that. It did work. It did work. So I've got.
I have to tell you that this thing of women and doctors is a very big issue with feminists.
Really?
Okay. Absolutely. That people treat everyone that don't understand the nuances. I mean, I went in recently. Recently, I had a heart attack.
Oh, I'm sorry.
A good one. I mean, a good one in the sense that it was a warning. But they did an angiogram, and in the angiogram, they you naked underneath this hospital gown, but then they take that off and they cover you with the thing for the scan to go through. And I was in this place with the doctor and two male nurses, okay, feeling vulnerable, even though it was okay, I was feeling
and
vulnerable.
Was the doctor and male?
So I was in the room, naked in the room with three men, two of them young enough to be my sons. And I actually sent a letter to the doctor and to the hospital afterwards. And I said, you know what? It's not on. I'm in a room. I said nothing untoward happened. I'm in a room. I'm naked. I'm vulnerable. You've got to have at least one woman in the room. You have to. And the surprising part of all of this is that when I told my doctor, when I went for a follow-up, he says to me, you know, I'm glad you brought it up, but the surprising part of this is that the person who chose who was going to be in your room was a woman doctor.
Yeah.
I rest my case. Gee. Anyway, so now you have perfect vision.
I do. Apparently, there's a big mess if you look behind with medical instruments. But thank goodness it doesn't affect me. But you know, Magda, I don't know how much you know about MRIs and that kind of thing. You know, the magnetic resonance imaging, those tests. They didn't exist in those days.
No, they didn't.
So they had no way of actually diagnosing properly. So it was only 10 years later that they could diagnose it accurately and say it was MS. So in between that, before that diagnosis, I also, you know, I had friends and pareja and you'd go out. And I thought I must just be a very dull, boring person, a real nerd. Because, you know, I'd be with friends and we'd go shopping and then go for lunch and do whatever. And they'd say, okay, let's go clubbing. And I think, are you mad? I was so exhausted. And I didn't realize I had the chronic fatigue syndrome, which is part of MS, which I didn't know about. You know, that was what I was suffering.
But I do know that MS has a lot of symptoms that can be diagnosed, that can have different diagnoses. It's actually difficult to actually hone in to say that it's MS.
Yes.
Tell me, what did this do to your confidence?
Well, that's the thing. My confidence was a bit sort of blown, but not too bad. I just carried on still. And, you know, it was just great to have friends that you could understand each other. And, you know, it was fine. So thank goodness my confidence didn't suffer too much.
Okay, but let's go on to your awesome career, because you, you had three successful one-woman plays.
Yes.
Called Sticky Jaws.
Yeah.
Is Every Sperm Sacred? And Meze, Mira, and Makeup.
Yes.
Tell me about them, because I also know that the last one, Meze, Mira, and Makeup, it went throughout South Africa, it went to Greece, it went to Australia, and recently, give us the good news. What happened recently with this play?
Recently in Hong Kong. I got this message out of the blue from somebody, from Emily from Hong Kong. And I thought, oh, I don't know anybody from Hong Kong and Emily. And she said, I would like to stage your play in Hong Kong. And it was Meze, Mira, and Makeup. So they had it translated into, I don't know if it was Cantonese or Mandarin. And it was performed. And it went very well. And for her, the issues were the same that I didn't realize, or we didn't realize, but about immigration and diaspora, because her first marriage was to a Mexican, and it didn't work out. And what she suffered and the criticism and the alienation from her community was very bad because she was a divorced woman. And it was also that thing of Daxena, you know, things and people from far away.
Okay, and these plays that you've performed in, they are all based on the challenges of growing up a Greek-speaking young girl, an adult in South Africa.
Tell me
what are the biggest challenges besides the parents' expectation that you're going to be a good girl?
Yeah. Well, the challenges are just sort of about identity and culture, who you are really. I mean, I am a South African because I was born here, but that Greekness is so much a part of my internal life and being.
Absolutely.
So that's what really affected me. And I have to tell you, Magda, you know, my mother thought for a long time I wouldn't get married, and she got into a bit of a panic. And she said what I thought was very funny. She said, all right, he doesn't have to be Greek or Cypriot as long as he's white and he's a Christian.
Okay, that's fair enough.
Yeah. But, you know, my poor husband now, who's not Greek but is a Philhellene, he's still, you know, he got a bit offended, you know.
And he's a wonderful human being, husband.
He is so wonderful. Yeah.
Has he learned how to speak Greek? Does he know how to speak
a
Greek?
Little bit, but not that much. But he's very funny because I told him that his name in Greek is Pavlo, because he's Paul. Pavlo. And he says, no. He doesn't want it because it reminds him of Pavlov's dog.
Okay, tell him we'll have to baptize him another name.
Yes, we will.
And tell me, you did a lot of the performing you did at Market Theatre. We invested a lot in the Market Theatre, in the laboratory of Market Theatre.
Yes,
teaching.
A course teaching, called Theatre and Life. Yeah.
Okay.
Which is basically life skills. And it was the creator of the Market Theatre Laboratory, Barney Simon, who did, I spoke to him about doing that, and he told me to write a premise.
A proposal.
And I did, and he approved it. And it was really, really wonderful, because it's a matter of learning just to speak, you know, and having good, ordinary conversation with people of other races, all South African, but all with their differences and their similarities. So it was a life skills course,
Which, especially for the marginalized black kids, was life-saving.
Yes, very,
because
very
the skills
so.
They didn't have a lot of access to.
Yeah, to white people, to different kinds of people, you know, and geography, they came from all over the country. Different venue destinations. Yeah.
And how long did you do these lessons for?
It was sort of from about 1985 to 2024. So that's 95, 2005, 2015, 2025. So
that's a long time.
30, 40 years. Yeah.
Oh, great. And it stopped. Assuming it stopped.
Unfortunately, it did have to stop. Yeah.
Okay. Everything has an expiration date.
Yes.
And sometimes there's a reason. I mean, sometimes the teacher gets old in the sense that you've got to limit your energy to things. But sometimes you need to move on. You also, I want to know, you've got, the title of your one play is very intriguing, which is that one, Is Every Sperm Sacred?
Yes.
Do you want to tell me about
that? I do want to tell you about that. And I want to tell you that I wish I'd explained to my mother, because she said to me, she tell me when I go to the church, what must I say to the people? They say, what play she got on? And Is Every Sperm Sacred is based on a satire by Monty Python in England. Okay. And they had the song, Every Sperm is Sacred, Every Sperm is Good, Every Sperm is Needed in Your Neighborhood. And so I called it Is Every Sperm Sacred, because in terms of life and survival and respect and chances for life and living. You know, is a sperm sacred? Is an ovary sacred? Is life sacred? Because it seems too cheap, you know.
Oh, yes. Okay. I was just about to say that, especially in the world we live now, lives are worthless.
Absolutely.
Lives appear to be worthless.
Yes.
Lives appear to be worthless. Tell me, these plays, I hear you talk a lot about your mother, so she's obviously one of the big influences in your life.
I would say she was almost like a muse in the most informal way, because the way she acted, the way she thought, the way she interacted was fascinating for all of us, you know. So, you know, because they had their own club of Greek women and how they speak and how they communicate. And, she was also very, very dramatic, as you know.
Although your mother looked so gentle when
that.
The image I have of her now, I mean, you're talking about a long time ago.
Yeah.
But your father appeared to be the strong, silent type.
Yeah, he was. He was, yeah.
But these strong, silent types like my father, I worry about them.
Because they're softies underneath,
Yes, I worry about them because they're hiding something, a sensitivity, a vulnerability. But your mother was always such a lady.
Yes,
so
exactly. That's the word I should have used earlier. Ladylike. That's why she thought if I went to drama school, I would learn to be more of a lady. But, you know, she wasn't aware of that kind of understanding of drama and thinking. It was like on the ground and rough and true.
You then moved on from acting, or not moved on, you broadened your repertoire and you turned to writing plays.
Well, not really. I only wrote one play, Acropolis Cafe. Yeah, which I'd like to rewrite again, about growing up in my father's shop. As I said, I feel like rewriting another draft of it. And that was the closest I got.
Why do you want, we all grew up in a cafe shop kind of environment, which we faced a lot of racism for, just by the way, because when you talk about racism in apartheid South Africa, it's not only black and white. The diaspora faced lots of racism.
Lots and lots. Well, in fact, I have to tell you, Magda, it's quite important point is that when I went to Australia and performed one of my plays, there was this Greek Australian who interviewed me, and he was lovely. We had a very nice interview, and he said it'll be out tomorrow. So I bought the newspaper the next day, and the headline was Wog Girl from South Africa. So I was horrified.
What the hell?
Yeah, Wog, WOG. So I phoned him and I said, what is this? But now it turns out it's a whole thing, Magda. I mean, now it's probably past, but I think in the 80s and 90s, most southern Mediterranean immigrants were known as WOGs, just a WOG. I don't know what it stands for, but I phoned him and he said, no, it's a compliment. So I said, well, what do you mean? What does it mean? So he said, no, that's what Southern Mediterraneans are called. And then I saw afterwards that there were, you know, theatre companies. There was one called Wog Boys and another one called Wogorama. So it's all about that Southern Mediterranean reality. Mm. Yeah.
But it wasn't a word that we used in South Africa. No. I don't remember hearing it in South Africa.
No. Well, this is the thing. Then I was interviewed on Australian radio, and I remember the woman said to me, she said, so Irene, we grew up in apartheid South Africa, but what was it like growing up as a wog in South Africa? And I said, well, we didn't have wogs in South Africa. And it's like she didn't believe me. She was like, she thought I was in denial. But I think what she also didn't get, which maybe I didn't explain more accurately, was there was no term like wog. There was the discrimination and, you know, the oppression in its own kind of way. But it wasn't called a particular word like wog.
I don't know if you remember, but during the apartheid years, I'm a bit older than you, so maybe my memory is fresher, but they created homelands for the blacks.
Yes.
For each group.
Yes.
They were considering sending the Greeks to Griqualand.
No, don't say okay. that. I don't know.
And I remember going to a rally, a political rally with my father, because my father didn't drive. And my area was the United Party. And the United Party had collapsed, that was up for grabs. And we went to the, I don't know who was speaking, and on stage was Mr. Lawoudis from the Greek community.
Right.
And I was highly offended because I thought to myself, you are a cultural community. You are not voted as a political party. He didn't represent us. So I was heckling like crazy. My father just gently moved away.
Oh, really?
He didn't say anything. And then the next meeting, he asked his ambassador to take him. He didn't ask me again, but I was highly offended that this man stood on stage next to the Republican the nationalist candidate, claimed the loyalty of the Greek-speaking community to him without a mandate.
How could
dare he?
Yes.
How could he?
Yes.
So I was heckling, but it was, I mean, that's why I say to you, I was very blessed with my parents because my father didn't say a word.
That
he just gently
amazing.
Moved two or three chairs down. And the next time he said, no, you don't have, we want, no, we're not going to go together. Yeah. Masi Bethro's coming to But it was, I mean, I don't think it's, I'm now in a lot of networks and, one of the girls that's on the network is from the colored community from South Africa, which for the listeners means mixed race. And she speaks of the oppression of the blacks. And I need to remind her of the members of the diaspora community in South Africa, the white members of the, we faced not as oppressive, but there was a stigmatization. There was a name.
Definitely
you're lower class because your father's a cafe owner. Yeah. And I used to tell
Yeah.
I mean, I faced that at work and I turned to my boss and I said to him, my cafe owner has sent 3 kids to uni and we've all got postgraduate degrees. What have you done?
Uh-huh.
He couldn't open his mouth again.
So,
yes. But tell me, how well accepted was this? It's easy to make a comedy out of what we suffered or what we lived through as Greek-speaking young women of being good girls and dressing appropriately and whatever that meant. It obviously was, you had a lot of fertile ground for material to put in your place.
In all the shows. Oh, yes.
Was it like therapy for you? Did it turn into therapy?
I think in a way it did. But I do have to say, I did go to psychotherapy for a long time, which I loved. And I still love my therapist because I think it was a big deal, you know. I don't know about your parents, but my parents had an arranged marriage, you know. So my mother saw my father once before they got engaged. So I didn't really believe it was possible to have a thing called romance or love or, you know, happiness and stuff. So in a way, that therapy did really help me. Yeah.
because, to work through it. Mm. I think all the parents of our generation had arranged marriage. I think very few of them didn't. Married for love.
Yeah, yeah. Very
and
few.
They were lucky if it developed into love or respect or whatever it's developed in. And not everyone got that blessing.
No.
So your therapy helped you with that, to work through the thing that life is good and life can bring love and surprises.
Yes. But
is also, that what opened you up to getting married?
Yes, I think it did. It did. I said to people, you know, if I hadn't been to therapy, there's no way I would have got married. Because, you know, I lost another feminist friend of mine, you know, because I got married. It was like I betrayed the sisterhood, you know. How could I do engage in such a thing? And,
I mean, how dare she?
Yeah.
Feminism is inclusion of everyone's right to be happy and access to what makes them happy.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, I'm glad you got married, and I'm sure you are glad you got married.
Yes, but I have to say, Magda, you know, I'm developing like a reputation now because Paul and his father, they are also men of another kind. You know, Paul's father, who lives in America, you know, he will say if we go and stay with them, okay, put the washing out and I'll do the washing. And he does the washing. He does cleaning. So Paul and his father are like that. And it's like unbelievable. And once my mother...
They're both feminists.
Yeah, they are. And I told my mother that, and she sort of shouted at my father, and she says, "Ide so papas to Paul, gani after, after, after." And then my father got cross and like, oh, well, you know, it's not what he grew up knowing and understanding. So, yeah.
I also know that you started hosting a radio show,
yes.
Elana Tabume.
Ne, ne.
And what brought that on? Because I know at some stage you started talking publicly about your challenges with multiple sclerosis.
Yes, I did. I did. Well, it was just the existence of the Greek radio, and I thought it would be a great thing to do. So I loved doing it. But, you know, I don't know. There's still issues now, so I don't know whether the radio is going to keep going or not. You know, it's like issues with money and... Power.
And you also do public presentations about your multiple sclerosis. Do you find that it helps other people or it helps you?
I haven't done enough of them, but I would like to do more of that, much more. So if you've got any contacts you can give me, please pass them on. Because
I think we need to, when you've got something that's unique and challenging, I think if you speak out, it makes those people with less confidence.
Yes. Feel
they feel
stronger.
As if they're not alone.
Yes.
They feel they can reach out. Tell me, what challenges specifically has multiple sclerosis presented to you in your life?
Well, look, you know, I can't walk properly. So I've got a limp and I walk very slowly, you know. So if we're going to go somewhere, you know, even if it's to a mall to watch a movie, you know, in terms of time and getting to the venue on time, sometimes it's easier to be in a wheelchair because you can move a bit faster. But there was a time when I would get a wheelchair at the airport or something to, you know, take me.
To facilitate.
Yeah, to facilitate. Mm-hmm. But these guys would go so fast. It was like major speeding, which was a bit sort of unnerving, but fine.
Can I ask you, and this is totally, you don't need to answer if you don't. Does multiple sclerosis is an inflammation of the nervous system?
Yes.
Does it affect you cognitively?
Is
there a loss of memory?
Yeah, apparently it does. I haven't noticed anything that huge yet, but I have noticed that, you know, sometimes if I'm performing, you know, I should have a script next to me to remind me if I lose words or some such thing. So not as bad as I thought, but, you know, it's just a danger that's there.
But also I think this is the kind of condition that it affects every individual in a slightly different way.
Yes, yes, it does.
Well, I think the one thing I liked when I saw you, she got this really nifty fold-up walking stick.
Yes, thank you.
It's this psychedelic walking stick that fits into your handbag.
Yeah, you fold it up.
Which I think is...
Yeah.
I think that's really great because it means that you can walk, but the minute you feel tired, you bring it out and it means you feel more independent.
Yes.
You don't have to worry about someone being right next to you to
grab
support your hand.
You and help you.
To support you.
But I have to tell you, the other night I went to a movie and then I battled on one stair and then all these people gathered around me and all tried to help me. And that became even worse because there was, you know, there was chaos. So there wasn't one point of support and reference, which Paul has been. But, you know, other people would say, no, I'm holding your arm. I'm not letting go. But they needed to let go. So I needed to be assertive about that as well.
Well, because in conditions like yours, there are certain people you have confidence in.
Yes.
And Paul is your confidence, or your sister,
knows.
Or whoever.
Yeah.
And he knows, and your sister also knows. So other people, if I reach out to you, you might not feel confident with me holding on to you because you don't know me.
Yeah. And you
it's
don't
also
know
the
me.
Proximity.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's both, and it's a proximity. So you've got to be confident that the person you're holding on to, you also comfortable with feeling, with touching.
Yeah.
Okay. Tell me of all your work that you've done. Which one is your particular baby? I know they're all children because I know this kind of work. There's so much. Is there anyone that has a special place in your heart or a?
Yeah, I think it would have to be Meze Miran makeup. It would just have to be because it was so Greek, and it was so much about how I grew up and how I adapted. Yeah.
Tell me also about you obviously have a lot of good co-workers.
Yes.
Tell me about the one I know is Renos Panoudis,
Vanessa Cook. Yeah, yeah.
Penny Flaskas.
That's right. But I have to tell you, sorry, Magda, I'm interrupting you a bit, but I also saw the Maria Callas movie.
See it was last week?
Yes, so moving and so beautiful and so sad and so Greek.
So did Angelina Jolie do a good job?
I think she did an excellent job. I really do,
But she's it's a very sad story. Her story is very sad.
Very
and
sad.
Yet she's a diva. She's iconic. Yeah. She's a legend.
Yeah, totally. Totally.
They actually showed it. It was a once-off screening before it gets launched in the theatres.
Yes, yes.
So you would recommend I go and see it when it comes
to
the...
Don't miss it. And I'll come with you for a second time and see it, if you like. But you're in Cyprus, so...
So you'll come, virtually to the movie theatre with me. Is there any point within your life that you've feel stands out particularly, whether sad or happy or inspiring?
I'm sure there are lots. There are lots.
I know you also edited the book on Barney Simon.
That's right. Which I created with my co-worker, Leela, who's very supportive. And I know I was attracted to her. We didn't know each other very well, but her name is Leela Henriques, and so she has got a Portuguese background, and she speaks such good English because she went to Oxford University.
Okay.
And so it's nice to have been able to compare that.
But it's also that Barney Simon was a legend. Barney Simon started the Market Theatre context that was really hostile.
Yeah.
He stood by it. He stood next to it. He stood in front of it.
No matter what.
And he made a real difference. And from what I read, the book you edited with your friend is the only type of biographical of him.
Yes, it is. It is. But I still want to maybe do more work with the book, maybe write like a school's textbook where some of the exercises are made very accessible and clear for students to use in the school.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what? I think in this demanding or challenging world that we live in, I think a lot of theory about history and is not as important as actually teaching people of how to express themselves in their particular way. Because you might be acting, I might be painting, someone else might be poetry writing. Yeah. And I think that's so necessary for us to bring out our creative self. I grew up in quite a creative family because my sister's an artist. She's had exhibitions. My two uncles are architects. My mother's also creative. Because I can't paint, I always grew up believing I'm not creative until I started writing. And then I realized that that's where my creativity lies.
Isn't that fantastic?
But I do think, especially in our world of activism and with the real challenges we have, creativity and art, theatre, singing, dancing is a much more productive way of working through it and working towards some kind of reconciliation.
Very much so. Oh, yes. But Magda, I know we've sort of spoken briefly about this, but not enough, I think. But my family went to Cyprus in 1974. When the wars happened and the Durki and everything came. And having been through that, survived that, and then going back to South Africa, and then June 76 happened, also indicated for me, you know, how politics just drives so much of our lives.
Mm-hmm. So within 2 years, you had two major conflicts.
Yeah.
And you, if I remember correctly, you said to me that on the day of the invasion, you were actually in Bendemili. You were in Gerenia.
Yes. Well,
had you left before the Turks landed, or were you still there when they landed?
No, before they landed. Because we had a cousin's wedding in Nicosia. So it was pure luck and chance that we left Bendemili. Otherwise, well, we've still got suitcases there with clothes and stuff.
Have you never been tempted to go back?
Oh, I have. Yeah.
Well, when you come again, I'll take you.
Some
people are challenged to go through checkpoints because of the recognition issue for whatever it means. But to me, I will not give up my homeland.
Good for
and
you.
I've also got and I also have a lot of friends in the north.
Do you?
To me, I'm not always the popular flavor of the month, but that's their problem, not mine.
Yeah, good.
So when you come again, and as I told you, you asked me about the lady at the restaurant at Bendemili.
Yes.
Who happens to be the missing mother-in-law of one of my good friends.
Oh, my goodness, really?
She's the mother, father, and daughter are still missing.
Oh.
The sons were lucky in inverted commas, because they were both in the army.
Yeah.
And they knew things were happening, and by the time her one son got to Bendemili to check up on his family, they disappeared. And no one knows where they are.
And is this the lady as well from Bendemili that I met?
Yes, it is. It's the one you met.
Yeah.
Bagona. Do you remember? It's the lady that owned the restaurant.
Yeah, she owned the restaurant.
That's her.
And do you remember what I told you that she told me?
Tell me.
This is amazing. You know, cicadas, Zizirus, So they hadn't seen much of them in South Africa. But in Cyprus, there were a lot. So when we were there in 74, she said to me, she said, there are too many Zizirus this year. There are too many. Gadika gotha yini. Something bad is going to happen.
Oh, okay. The nature knows when something bad is going to happen. But, I mean, I watch people that have got missing, and it's one of the biggest crimes. I don't know what it's called, a crime, but I watch people that have had family missing, and it eats away at your soul. I mean, you know your family's dead, but you don't have closure. You don't know what happened to them. You don't know where they're buried. And it's not so much about putting them in a grave, but it's about going there and planting flowers or saying a prayer.
Yes.
I mean, that's why their son is really got very serious health problems, which to me stems from the poison inside of not knowing his family is, what happened to his family. And when you come, I will introduce you to my friend Katie.
That would be wonderful.
Who was the daughter-in-law of this woman.
Oh, really? How fantastic. Okay, I'll be coming soon, Magdamo.
Good. Okay. I'll keep, you know where to find me. I think that's a really good note to end on, because you and I like storytelling.
Yes.
I like making a space for storytelling.
Fantastic.
Although I am a chatterbox as well.
Good.
But I think these stories need to come out.
Yes, they do.
People need to talk, need to be able to talk.
Well, even Barney Simon did make a thing about the importance of gossip. Because there's so much that comes out in that. Yeah.
Exactly.
People just chattering.
Because you bring out your percent.
Yeah.
Yes. Because you bring out your personality. People read what they want to read. A lot of time facts come out that you never knew about. But I do. After our meeting in Gauteng.
Nah. Gauteng.
For dinner. I actually called Katie the next day. And I said to her, you're not going to believe what I just heard yesterday on the other side of the bloody world from someone I haven't seen for years. So she was, I mean, we'll make sure you meet. We'll make
Fantastic.
Sure you meet.
Fantastic. That's beautiful.
Okay.
Thanks so
Is there
much,
anything
my
else
friend.
You want to say before we close?
Oh, you know, I hope nothing comes to me half an hour later.
That's okay. You've said a lot that's important. As I said to me, you really are inspiring because you've combined your trade with your activism.
Mm.
And doing this with MS is no joke, because I've seen people around me. It's a real challenge.
But you're blessed
because you've got your family.
Yes.
You've got your sisters
and
like a rock.
Support.
And you've got your Paul, who's an awesome human being.
Yeah, and a rock.
And a rock. And you've got, beyond your sister, you've got the rest of the family that... Yeah. And it must also be your drama family that supports you.
Very much so.
So to me, it's you're an inspiration.
Thank
Carry
you
on rocking.
So much. Thanks, Mangwamukesi. Rock sister, rock.
It's rock sisters. And so I look forward to you reaching out to me when you come, and I will take
you
to Bendemili, and I'll get you to meet my friend Katie.
Okay.
Thank you for sharing with me.
Thank
and to
you.
The listeners, thank you for listening. And see you soon.
Okay, bravo. Vilakia Pola. Thanks.
Vilakia.
Bye.
The first trilingual podcast station of Cyprus. Island Talks. Open, diverse, free.